Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 966. Dramatis Personae of the Russiagate PSYOP. This is being recorded on July 25th of the year 2017. What we are going to be doing, I was going to do a show about some of the really frightening developments vis-a-vis the high-profile hacks and the new Cold War, and some excellent work by Parafractal arguing the possibility of hacking nuclear power plants with all that entails and all that would result in. That, however, is going to be deferred to our next program for the record 967. There is so much going on in the world. I want to get to that, not just the new Cold War. There is a lot going on in Japan, for example. However, we're going to have to defer that a couple of weeks at least. We are hearing all about, of course, how the Russians have been manipulating Donald Trump, etc., etc. There is an article that has had a lot of distribution in the media from the New Republic talking about discussing the Russian mob connections of Donald Trump and how, not surprisingly, a lot of Russian mob money has been laundered through, apparently been laundered through Donald Trump's real estate and perhaps casino operations. As a general consideration, both casinos and real estate are traditional vehicles for money laundering. What the article does not do, predictably, frankly, for the New Republic, is to cut to the chase, and we're going to be doing that here. Just by way of example, ExxonMobil also has had extensive dealings, business dealings with Russia. That does not make ExxonMobil a Russian front or anything of that kind. That is perhaps a good context to examine the firestorm of propaganda dressed up as journalism that we are seeing. In a nutshell, what we are going to be doing in this program is examining the key players in Russiagate, and what we are going to find is that this goes back, the key players go back not only to the systematic manipulation of the American electoral process through covert action, both by the intelligence community and by the overlapping Republican Party, but it goes all the way back to the key players in the beginning of the first Cold War, the Joe McCarthy team. In a nutshell, what we're going to begin doing, we're going to look at some of the deep politics of this as well. We're going to begin by reviewing information about the point man for Donald Trump's business dealings in Russia. That is a CIA contract agent and FBI informant named Felix Sater, S-A-T-E-R. And again, he is the point man for all of Trump's Russia dealings, almost certainly helping to set up a lot of this as an op. One of the things we are hearing about is a fellow named Robert Goldstone. And Goldstone is again, being portrayed as a Russian agent, blah, blah, blah. Actually, he is a journalistic foot soldier for the Rupert Murdoch journalistic empire. Not Russia, Rupert Murdoch. We're going to be taking a look at Roger Stone. Roger Stone was in touch with the WikiLeaks network and was the campaign manager for Donald Trump and sort of the go-to dirty tricks guy for the Trump campaign. Roger Stone got his beginnings in politics as a dirty tricks operative for Richard Nixon's 1972 Watergate team. And we should note that the person who introduced Roger Stone to Donald Trump was Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn, of course, the right-hand man for Joe McCarthy and the red-baiting scares of the late 40s and early 1950s. We're then going to take a look at a very important article from Consortium News by Robert Perry, talking about the Russian lawyer who, again, supposedly is a KGB, FSB, Kremlin operative. This is a woman named Natali Veselnitskaya, Veselnitskaya. Turns out her dealings actually were an attempt to get a revealing documentary unmasking the fraud behind the Magnitsky Act that was actually made by a Russian filmmaker named Nekrasov, who was an opponent of Vladimir Putin. But after he began investigating the facts behind the Magnitsky Act, he could not ignore the fact that basically this was an okey-doke. And the contacts between Ms. Veselnitskaya and Donald Trump arranged, Donald Trump Jr., I should say, arranged by Rob Goldstone, the Rupert Murdoch journalistic foot soldier portrayed to us as a Kremlin dupe, etc. Those contacts were to help arrange for the distribution of the Magnitsky documentary made by Putin opponent Nekrasov. We're going to take a look next at a major factor in the Electoral College defeat of Hillary Clinton in the recent election, and that was the number that she was defeated. Well, really, we should note in passing that 48% of the eligible voters did not vote, and that is more than a little significant. Something like 77,000 votes in three states wound up deciding the Electoral College. We are going to take a look at the role of third-party candidates, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, and Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, in helping to assure the victory of Donald Trump in the Electoral College. I would note, although we're going to link to articles about this, I'm not going to read it, but Roger Stone, the aforementioned Roy Cohn-linked, Nixon-linked, dirty tricks operative for Donald Trump and many others, was pushing for both Gary Johnson and Jill Stein to be admitted into the debates once Hillary Clinton clinched the Democratic nomination. We're then going to take a look at Roger Stone's role in helping to promote Gary Johnson's Libertarian Party. Gary Johnson is a fellow who has had a certain amount of gravitas. Glenn Greenwald, not surprisingly among others, is a big Gary Johnson fan. Gary Johnson's Libertarian Party agenda advocates the elimination of Social Security, the elimination of Medicare, the elimination of the EPA relying on environmental abuses, to be corrected by private citizens filing suit against some of the gigantic corporations that will be despoiling the environment. That is simply, from a practical standpoint, unworkable. In short, basically, the Gary Johnson libertarian agenda is in many ways being realized by the Trump administration and the GOP. Not surprisingly, the Libertarian Party was founded by, drumroll please, fanfare please, the Koch brothers. We're going to take a look at Roger Stone's, one of his favorite electoral tricks, which is to field a third-party spoiler candidate. In 1980, he was one of the people who helped to promote John Anderson as an independent candidate for president, and it was John Anderson's inclusion on the New York State electoral ballot as a candidate for the Liberal Party that helped to deliver New York to Ronald Reagan, and that helped Reagan's victory. And who helped make the arrangements for Roger Stone and John Anderson with the Liberal Party? Roy Cohn, McCarthy's right-hand man and Trump lawyer, and one of Roy Cohn's organized crime associates, Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, S-A-L-E-R-N-O. We talked about Tony Salerno and his links to Donald Trump in For the Record 903 and at greater length in For the Record 933, dealing with David K. Johnston's The Making of Donald Trump. I would note in passing that the Russian mob, all of the ethnic mafias in the U.S., report to the American, really Italian and Sicilian mafia. The point being that when it came to Roger Stone to use his favorite tactic of a spoiler candidate to help elect Ronald Reagan, he turned to Roy Cohn, attorney for Donald Trump, former right-hand legal man to Joe McCarthy, and one of Roy Cohn's many mob clients, Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, one of the mob associates of Donald Trump. Ronald Reagan benefited at great length from the media support of Rupert Murdoch. We're next going to look at a Consortium News article by Robert Perry. Who do you think introduced Rupert Murdoch to Ronald Reagan and helped to set up that liaison? Roy Cohn, the very same Roy Cohn. We're then going to review some of the deep politics behind the McCarthy campaign. We're going to review from For the Record 578, how Joe McCarthy made use of an intelligence network run by John Frenchy Grombach, G-R-O-M-B-A-C-H, a former Mil-Intel man who fed information to the CIA and to Joe McCarthy. And John Frenchy Grombach's key source in this intelligence operation was none other than General Karl Wolf of the SS, Heinrich Himmler's right-hand man. We're then going to take a look, reviewing from AFA number 2 from the spring of 1984, about the deep politics behind Joe McCarthy. We're going to take a look at Joe McCarthy's main financial backers, two reactionary and pro-Nazi industrialists, Frank from Wisconsin, Frank Susenbrenner, and Walter Harnischfeger. And we're going to conclude by taking a look, although much of the information, due to the limitations of time, will necessarily have to come from the description, the written description for the show. We're going to take a look at Robert Mueller. He is the Russiagate special prosecutor, and a very special prosecutor he is. In For the Record 310, recorded in early July of 2001, I pointed out that Robert Mueller was in all probability appointed to be head of the FBI in order to cover up the BCCI links, because it is with the Bank of Credit and Commerce International that one finds one of the central points of intersection between the business dealings of George Walker Bush and the Bin Laden family.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
When On March 20th of 2000, two of the Operation Green Quest raids took place, and in fact, it turned out that there were very extensive dealings between some of the financing apparatus for Muslim Brotherhood-derived networks such as Al-Qaeda and Hamas. It ran to, among other institutions, not only the Bank al-Taqwa, but to the Republican Party and the Islamic Free Market Institute set up by Karl Rove and Grover Norquist. Karl Rove financed in a large measure the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, almost certainly using bots to channel the small anonymous donations about which we heard so much. Predictably, as that investigation unfolded, it was covered up. Now, even the April 18th, 2002 article, a very important one, by Glenn R. Simpson from page A4 of the Wall Street Journal, is not available online. An indication of where we have gotten to. So we're going to take a look at Robert Mueller, a very special prosecutor indeed, at the end of the program. That is what is on tap. So plunging right in. From the aforementioned book, The Making of Donald Trump, by David K. Johnston, about Felix Sater, the point man for Donald Trump's dealings with Russia, including the Russian organized crime figures about which we have heard so much, except for meaningful analysis of how they came to be. There is every indication that the extraordinarily lenient treatment resulted from Sater playing a get-out-of-jail-free card. This is in connection with Sater's felonies. Shortly before his secret guilty plea, Sater became a freelance operative of the Central Intelligence Agency. One of his fellow stock swindlers, Salvatore Luria, wrote a book about it, The Scorpion and the Frog. Luria's book is described on its cover as, quote, the true story of one man's fraudulent rise and fall in the Wall Street of the 90s, unquote. According to Luria and the court files that have been unsealed, Sater helped the CIA buy small missiles before they got the terrorists. He also provided other purported national security services for a reported fee of $300,000. One wonders what those may have been. Repeating, according to Luria and the court files that have been unsealed, Sater helped the CIA buy small missiles before they got the terrorists. He also provided other purported national security services for a reported fee of $300,000. Stories abound as to what else Sater may or may not have done in the area of national security. If there were a way of conclusively verifying it, which of course there isn't, I would bet that laying the groundwork for the intelligence operation known as Russiagate was one of those. Not only something that is being used to hold Donald Trump as a political prisoner, and will ultimately, in my opinion, be used to oust him in favor of Mike Pence, and as vile as Donald Trump is, would you get President Pence? Every bit as bad, if not worse, than Donald Trump, but minus the vulgarity and the erraticism. Once again, from the reviewing from about Felix Sater and his key work as the point element for Donald Trump's dealings with the Russians. Sater worked on a plan for a Trump Tower in Moscow as recently as the fall of 2015, but he said that came to a halt because of Trump's presidential campaign. And even in January of 2016, 17 of this year. It was that very same CIA and FBI-linked Felix Sater, also, of course, linked to the Russian organized crime milieu, who was helping to network between members of the Trump campaign and people in Russia and Ukraine. Nevertheless, in late January, Sater and a Ukrainian lawmaker reportedly met with Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, at a New York hotel. According to the Times, they discussed a plan that involved the U.S. lifting sanctions against Russia, and Cohen said he hand-delivered the plan in a sealed envelope to then-National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Cohen later denied delivering the envelope to anyone in the White House, according to the Washington Post. Again, that guy, of course, you won't hear about his links to CIA and FBI. That guy is the point man in Trump's Russia dealings, almost certainly helping to set that up, certainly helping to set up a penetration operation in Russia, and also helping to set up the destabilization of Donald Trump, not unlike the way Richard Nixon was set up in the Watergate burglary. Nixon then won the election and was turned out of office in favor of Gerald Ford. Now, Rob Goldstone, somebody we're being told is a Russian operative, blah, 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 blah. Who is Rob Goldstone? Where does he come from? The New York Times of July 14th, 2017, has an article, an op-ed column actually by Peter Jukes, J as in John, U, K as in kangaroo, E-S, Britain's Gift to America, the New Sleazocracy. Skipping down. According to Mr. Goldstone's account, he moved from local journalism to work for Rupert Murdoch's best-selling British daily newspaper, The Sun, and other tabloids before turning to public relations for pop stars. The CV for Rob Goldstone, again, the Kremlin agent, blah, 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 who set up Donald Trump Jr.'s meetings with Ms. Veselnitskaya. He is a was a journalistic foot soldier for the Murdoch media empire. Now, Roger Stone, the campaign manager for Donald Trump, then later the dirty tricks operative for the Trump campaign, in touch with WikiLeaks during the campaign and almost certainly helping to set up the nonsense about Russia being behind the high-profile hacks, as I've called them, most of which were not hacks at all. We'll talk more about that in the next program. A CNN story from May 20th of this year by Michael D'Antonio. Is Roger Stone making good on a 40-year-old grudge? In the middle of the Watergate scandal, Stone, who engaged in dirty tricks during Richard Nixon's 1972 campaign, was discovered to have hired a Republican operative to infiltrate the George McGovern campaign and was subsequently fired from his job. After the president's resignation, Stone remained an ardent Nixon apologist and loyalist. He even had the man's face tattooed on his back and devoted his life to ruthless anything-goes politics or political consulting, as you may know it. Stone's motto was and continues to be, quote, admit nothing, deny everything, launch counterattack, unquote. And anyone who has watched Trump closely over the years would think it was his personal slogan, too. Stone was introduced to Donald Trump in the 1980s by the notorious Roy Cohn, then a Manhattan lawyer who represented several, reputed mobsters. Cohn had become infamous in the 1950s as the chief inquisitor during Joe McCarthy's Red Scare hearings in the U.S. Senate. After McCarthy's Inquisition was shut down, Cohn began a new life as a political and legal fixer. He became a mentor to Roger Stone and Donald Trump and taught both men how to manipulate the media and bully opponents. Not mentioned here is he became a mob lawyer as well. Repeating his last couple of sentences. Roger Stone was introduced to Trump in the 1980s by the notorious Roy Cohn. Then a Manhattan lawyer who represented several reputed mobsters, Cohn had become infamous in the 1950s as the chief inquisitor during Joe McCarthy's Red Scare hearings in the United States Senate. After McCarthy's Inquisition was shut down, Cohn began a new life as a political and legal fixer. He became a mentor to Stone and Trump and taught both men how to manipulate the media and bully opponents. Very interesting indeed. Now, the aforementioned Rupert Murdoch, foot journalistic foot soldier Rob Goldstone, is the public relations man for pop stars who introduced Donald Trump Jr. to a Russian lawyer named Natalie Veselnitskaya. A very important article about one of the things that underlay that meeting was posted on the Consortium News website of July 13th of 2017 by Robert Perry, How Russiagate Met the Magnitsky Myth. Near the center of the current furor over Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer in June of 2016 is a documentary that almost no one in the West has been allowed to see, a film that flips the script on the story of the late Sergei Magnitsky and his employer hedge fund operator William Browder. Donald Trump Jr., speaking at the 2016 Republican National Convention, I'm going to skip that paragraph. The Russian lawyer, Natalie Veselnitskaya, who met with Trump Jr. and other advisors to Donald Trump Sr.'s campaign, represented a company that had run afoul of a U.S. investigation into money laundering allegedly connected to the Magnitsky case and his death in a Russian prison in 2009. His death sparked a campaign headed by William Browder, who used his wealth and clout to lobby the U.S. Congress in 2012 to enact the Magnitsky Act to punish alleged human rights abusers in Russia. The law became what might be called the first shot in the new Cold War. According to Browder's narrative, companies ostensibly under his control had been hijacked by corrupt Russian officials in furtherance of a $230 million tax fraud scheme. He then dispatched his lawyer, unquote, Magnitsky, to investigate, and after supposedly uncovering evidence of the fraud, Magnitsky blew the whistle only to be arrested by the same corrupt officials who then had him locked up in prison, where he died of heart failure from physical abuse. Despite Russian denials and the dog-ate-my-homework quality of Browder's self-serving narrative, the dramatic tale became a cause célèbre in the West. The story eventually attracted the attention of Russian filmmaker Andrei Nekrasov, or Nekrasov, N-E-K-R-A-S-O-V, a known critic of President Vladimir Putin. Nekrasov decided to produce a docudrama that would present Browder's narrative to a wider public. Nekrasov even said he hoped that he might recruit Browder as the narrator of the tale. However, the project took an unexpected turn when Nekrasov's research, bear in mind that he was a political opponent of Vladimir Putin, beginning again, however, the project took an unexpected turn when Nekrasov's research kept turning up contradictions to Browder's storyline, which began to look more and more like a corporate cover story. Nekrasov discovered that a woman working in Browder's company was the actual whistleblower and that Magnitsky, rather than a crusading lawyer, was an accountant who himself was implicated in the scheme. One more time. Nekrasov, again, a Putin opponent, discovered that a woman working in Browder's company was the actual whistleblower, and that Magnitsky, rather than a crusading lawyer, was an accountant who was himself implicated in Browder's scheme. So the planned docudrama suddenly was transformed into a documentary with a dramatic reversal as Nekrasov struggles with what he knows will be a dangerous decision to confront Browder with what appear to be deceptions. In the film, you see Browder go from a friendly collaborator into an angry adversary who tries to bully Nekrasov into backing down. Ultimately, Nekrasov completes his extraordinary film entitled The Magnitsky Act Behind the Scenes, and it was set for a premiere at the European Parliament in Brussels in April of 2016. However, at the last moment, faced with Browder's legal threats, the parliamentarians pulled the plug. Nekrasov encountered similar resistance in the United States, a situation that in part brought Natalie Veselnitskaya into this controversy. As a lawyer defending Previzon, Previzon, a real estate company registered in Cyprus on a money laundering charge, she was dealing with U.S. prosecutors in New York City, and in that role became an advocate for lifting the U.S. sanctions, the Washington Post reported. That was when she turned to promoter Rob Goldstone to set up a meeting at Trump Tower with Donald Trump Jr. To secure the sit-down on June 9, 2016, Goldstone dangled the prospect that Veselnitskaya had some derogatory financial information from the Russian government about Russians supporting the Democratic National Committee. Now, bear in mind again that Rob Goldstone got his professional start as a journalistic foot soldier for Rupert Murdoch. We're going to come back to Murdoch later in our discussion. Donald Trump, let me begin with repeating that last sentence. Bear in mind Goldstone's Rupert Murdoch affiliation. To secure the sit-down on June 9, 2016, Goldstone dangled the prospect that Veselnitskaya had some derogatory financial information from the Russian government about Russians supporting the Democratic National Committee. Trump Jr. jumped at the possibility and brought senior Trump campaign advisors Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner along. By all accounts, Veselnitskaya had little or nothing to offer about the DNC and turned the conversation instead to the Magnitsky Act and Putin's retaliatory measure to the sanctions, canceling a program in which American parents adopted Russian children. One source told me that Veselnitskaya also wanted to enhance her stature in Russia with the boast that she had taken a meeting at Trump Tower with Trump's son. But another goal of Veselnitskaya's U.S. trip was to participate in an effort to give Americans a chance to see Nekrasov's blacklisted documentary. She traveled to Washington in the days after her Trump Tower meeting and attended the House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, according to the Washington Post. And then the article, which is reproduced in part in the written description for the Record 966 and will be published, reveals basically how the New York Times and the Washington Post did everything they could to suppress the documentary. The point being here that the goal of the meeting between Donald Trump and Natalie Veselnitskaya was not, you know, Kremlin intrigue and so on and so forth, but to lift the journalistic blackout in the U.S. on the Nekrasov documentary about Magnitsky. And bear in mind that Nekrasov is a political opponent of Vladimir Putin, began making the film presumably on the assumption that it would reveal more about Putin's dark side, so to speak. In fact, it did not reveal anything of the kind. It, in fact, revealed some of the fraud behind what Magnitsky was involved in, and some of the less than candid dealings or attitudes or manifestations of William Browder. And again, who set up the meeting between Veselnitskaya and Donald Trump? Former Rupert Murdoch journalistic foot soldier Rob Goldstone.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, much has been made about how Hillary Clinton lost the election, etc., etc. I would note something that very few have taken note of. 48% of the eligible voters did not vote. In the 2014 elections, which allowed the Republicans to gain control of the U.S. Senate, there was an historically low U.S. voter turnout, 29%. That's 29% of the eligible voters turned out, enabling the Republicans to gain control of the U.S. Senate. They stonewalled Barack Obama's attempts at appointing a Supreme Court justice, and that allowed Donald Trump and the Republicans to appoint a Federalist Society chosen replacement for the late Antonin Scalia, and that is Neil Gorsuch. So get ready for decades of Republican Federalist Society rulings from the Supreme Court. My guess is that 84 or 85-year-old Ruth Bader Ginsburg, although in pretty good shape for her age, will experience what the intelligence community refers to as health degradation. Don't be surprised if John Paul Stevens experiences the same thing, allowing Donald Trump to appoint a third of the Supreme Court. What we're going to look at next is one of the favorite gambits of the aforementioned Roger Stone, introduced, by the way, to Donald Trump by none other than Roy Cohn. And that is Roger Stone's gambit of using a third-party spoiler to basically place his chosen candidate into office. Now, the Libertarian Party, founded by the Koch brothers, ran Gary Johnson as a candidate in 2012, and also in 2012, he was supported by none other than Roger Stone. This from Mark Ames in the NSFW Corp of November 6th of 2012. The Gary Johnson swindle and the degradation of third-party politics. The fact that Gary Johnson's Libertarian Party was founded and funded by the Koch brothers. David Koch ran as the Libertarian Party's VP in 1980 in order to make it easier for the Kochs to shovel more money into the party and the Libertarian cause. And that Gary Johnson was a longtime loyal Republican. Considering all of this and what's at stake in presidential elections, it would seem to be malpractice for a journalist to assume there isn't a story or several stories to be found under the Gary Johnson rock. Stories that matter and that are bizarre and fun and grotesque in their own right. Exhibit A. Roger Stone, a self-described GOP hitman with a giant tattoo of Richard Nixon's face etched across his back. Roger Stone, the skeeziest, sleaziest, meanest, most flamboyant, and nihilistic of any Republican dirty trickster working the field going back a few decades, the satanic zealot of Republican black ops, who's had a hand in just about every major GOP election crime you've heard of, and lots more you had not heard of. Everyone seems to have forgotten already, but last spring, that was 2012, Roger Stone made a big public stink about how he's fed up with the Republican Party and the two-party stranglehold and joined Gary Johnson's Libertarian Party campaign. Pro bono. Because democratic idealism and principles are what Roger Stone is all about. And skipping down, about Roger Stone's role in helping to elect Ronald Reagan by basically manipulating the vote in New York State by putting John Anderson, a Republican, quote, independent, unquote, from the Trilateral Commission, by the way, on as an alternative to Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. It was John Anderson's endorsement by the Liberal Party in New York that handed the New York State, the second largest electoral vote entity, to Ronald Reagan and helped to elect Ronald Reagan. In New York State, in addition to the Republican and Democratic parties, there are also two parties, the Conservative and the Liberal Party. Usually the Conservative Party candidate is the Republican candidate, and the Liberal Party candidate is the Democratic candidate. That was not true in 1980 when Republican, quote, independent, unquote, and Trilateral Commission member John Anderson got the Liberal Party endorsement. And that came as a result of a gambit by Roger Stone and Roy Cohn, about whom we've heard so much, who basically channeled a bribe to the Liberal Party through a mobster in New York named Anthony, quote, Fat Tony, unquote, Salerno, who in For the Record 903 and even more in For the Record 933, we looked at as not only one of Roy Cohn's mob clients, but one of Donald Trump's organized crime associates as well. And of the Roger Stone, Roy Cohn, Fat Tony Salerno gambit in helping to put John Anderson on the New York ballot as the Liberal Party candidate, this something that gave Ronald Reagan a victory in New York. We read the following, this coming from a Weekly Standard article in 2007 and accessed by Mark Ames in this NSFW Corp article from November 6th of 2012. This episode comes from a rather candid interview Roger Stone gave to the Weekly Standard in 2007, and in it he describes how the most effective election fraud trick of all is using a credible third-party candidate to split the opposition's vote. In 1980, Stone's candidate was Ronald Reagan, and his enemy was incumbent President Jimmy Carter. The wild card in the 1980 election was a popular Illinois liberal Republican named John Anderson, who lost in the primaries against Reagan and decided to run against him and Carter anyway, given his popularity and apparent disgust with both Reagan and Carter. John Anderson's biggest problem was getting his name on the ballots. Roger Stone realized that if Anderson could get on the New York State ballot, it could split the liberal vote and hand the electoral prize to Ronald Reagan. So Stone seeks help from a political operative so evil he makes Roger Stone look like a Mormon. Roy Cohn, Senator McCarthy's right-hand henchman during the red-baiting hearings. Cohn brings a mobster named Fat Tony Salerno with him, and they ask Roger Stone what his problem is and how they might get help. Roger Stone's answer, Roger Stone's problem was simple. Stone wanted to get Mr. Clean outsider John Anderson on the New York State ballot as a third-party candidate to drain votes from Carter, but there wasn't nearly enough time to make it happen. Most people were led to believe that Anderson would naturally split the Republican vote, but that wasn't the case at all. Privately, polls showed that in tight state races, Anderson's candidacy caused far more damage to Carter than to Reagan. Stone, who going back to his class elections in high school has been a proponent of recruiting Patsy candidates to split the other guy's support, remembers suggesting to Cohn that if they could figure out a way to make John Anderson the Liberal Party nominee in New York, with Jimmy Carter picking up the Democratic nod, Reagan might win the state in a three-way race. Roy says, "Let me look into it," unquote. Cohn then told Fat Tony Salerno, quote, "You need to go visit this lawyer, a lawyer who shall remain nameless, and see what his number is." I said, "Roy, I don't understand." Roy says, "How much cash he wants. Dumb F blank, 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 blank." Stone balked when he found out the guy wanted $125,000 in cash to grease the skids. And Cohn wanted to know what the problem was. Stone told him he didn't have $125,000. And Cohn said, "That's not the problem. How does he want it?" Cohn sent Stone on an errand a few days later. "There's a suitcase." Stone says, "I don't look in the suitcase. I don't even know what was in the suitcase. I take the suitcase to the law office. I drop it off." 2 days later, they have a convention. Liberals decide they're endorsing John Anderson for president. It's a three-way race now in New York State. Reagan wins with 46% of the vote. "I paid his law firm legal fees. I don't know what he did for the money, but whatever it was, the Liberal Party reached its conclusion out of a matter of principle." By the way, it says P-R-I-N-C-I-P-L-E. Maybe it should have been P-R-I-N-C-I-P-A-L. I ask him how he feels about this in retrospect. This is Stone. "He seems to feel pretty good now that certain statutes of limitations are up." Quote, "Reagan got the electoral votes in New York State. We saved the country," unquote, Stone says with characteristic understatement. More Carter would have been an unmitigated disaster, unquote. So again, look how Richard Nixon, Roger Stone, Roy Cohn, and the whole red-baiting Cold War I team of Joe McCarthy figure into the evolution of this networking. And how did Rupert Murdoch come to become a big Republican journalistic spear carrier? Let's let Robert Perry tell us in yet another article from Consortium News, this from January 28th, of 2015. How Roy Cohn helped Rupert Murdoch. The article begins, "Rupert Murdoch, the global media mogul who is now a kingmaker in American politics, was brought into those power circles by the infamous lawyer activist Roy Cohn, who arranged Murdoch's first Oval Office meeting with President Ronald Reagan in 1983, according to documents released by Reagan's presidential library. I had one interest when Tom Bolin and I first brought Rupert Murdoch and Governor Reagan together, and that was that at least one major publisher in this country would become and remain pro-Reagan," Cohn wrote in the January 27, 1983 letter to senior White House aides Edwin Meese, James Baker, and Michael Deaver. "Mr. Murdoch has performed to the limit up through and including today. So who basically forms the liaison between Rupert Murdoch and the Reagan administration? And from that point forward, of course, Rupert Murdoch's journalistic empire, perhaps most significantly manifested in this country by Fox News. Once again, Roy Cohn, Phil McCarthy's right-hand man.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Now, we're going to go into some of the deep politics behind Joe McCarthy, reviewing something that we looked at in For the Record 578. One of the information sources or propaganda sources who was utilized by Joe McCarthy to tar his political opponents was a network being operated by a military intelligence officer named John, nicknamed Frenchy, F-R-E-N-C-H-Y, Grombach, G-R-O-M-B-A-C-H. Grombach, in turn, drew on an intelligence network from Europe that was headed up by SS General Karl Wolff, Heinrich Himmler's personal adjutant. From Blowback by Christopher Simpson, one of Grombach's most important assets, according to U.S. naval intelligence records obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, was SS General Karl Wolff, a major war criminal who had gone into the arms trade in Europe after the war. Grombach worked simultaneously under contract to the Department of State and the CIA. The ex-military intelligence man succeeded in creating, quote, one of the most unusual organizations in the history of the federal government, according to CIA Inspector General Lyman Kirkpatrick. Quote, it was developed completely outside of the normal government structure, but it used all of the normal cover and communications facilities normally operated by intelligence organizations, and yet never was under any control from Washington, unquote. By the early 1950s, the U.S. government was bankrolling Grombach's underground activities at more than $1 million annually, Kirkpatrick has said. Grombach banked on his close connections with Senators Joseph McCarthy, William Jenner, and other members of the extreme Republican right to propel him to national power. Grombach's outfit effectively became the foreign espionage agency for the far right, often serving as the overseas complement to McCarthy's generally warm relations with J. Edgar Hoover's FBI at home. U.S. government contracts bankrolling a network of former Nazis and Nazi collaborators gave him much of the ammunition he needed to do the job. Grombach used his networks primarily to gather dirt. This was the American agent's specialty, his true passion, political dirt, sexual dirt, any kind of compromising information at all. He got into a lot of garbage pails, as Kirkpatrick puts it, and issued dirty linen reports on Americans, unquote. Grombach, again still quoting, Grombach collected scandal, cataloged it, and used it carefully just as he had done during the earlier McCormick investigation. He leaked smears to his political allies in Congress and the press when it suited his purposes to do so. Grombach and congressional internal security investigators bartered these dossiers with one another almost as though they were boys trading baseball cards. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Again, one of the major sources that Joe McCarthy used, an intelligence network operated by Heinrich Himmler's personal adjutant. More about the deep politics of Joe McCarthy, because as we have seen, what we are seeing with Russiagate, the deep political networking going back to the genesis of Cold War I, is once again Roy Cohn and the forces that have evolved from Joe McCarthy. Reviewing some information that we looked at in AFA number 2 from the spring of 1984. This is The Nightmare Decade, subtitled The Life and Times of Senator Joe McCarthy by Fred J. Cook, published in hardcover by Random House, copyright 1971 by Fred Cook. What this is talking about is McCarthy's attacks on the Malmedy massacre hearings in Congress during the Battle of the Bulge, an SS battalion headed up by SS General, by then Colonel Jochen Peiper, massacred a bunch of American POWs at Malmedy in Belgium. They were ultimately convicted of war crimes. Joe McCarthy conducted hearings into that and attacked the American veterans and victims of the SS. And of some of the deep political backing of Joe McCarthy, we read the following. Why did he rage in defense of the Nazi murderers of American soldiers? The answer lies in the influence exerted by some of McCarthy's ultra-conservative, even pro-Nazi backers in Wisconsin. McCarthy had been bankrolled in his political campaigns by such leaders of the Wisconsin's powerful German-American community as Frank Susan Brenner, S-U-S-E-N, B-R-E-N-N-E-R, and Walter Harnischfeger, H-A-R-N-I-S-C-H-F-E-G-E-R. Susan Brenner was the president of the Kimberly-Clark Paper Company and president of the board of the University of Wisconsin. Harnischfeger was president of the Harnischfeger Company of Milwaukee, makers of traveling cranes, overhead machinery, and prefabricated houses. Both men were known as being fiercely pro-German. McCarthy showed not the slightest repugnance for Harnischfeger's passionate ultra-rightism and admiration for Adolf Hitler. Before the war, one of the manufacturer's nephews attending the University of Wisconsin had shocked fellow students by displaying an autographed copy of Mein Kampf and flaunting a watch chain swastika. During the war, Harnischfeger had advocated a negotiated peace with Germany, and as soon as the war ended, he played a leading role in organizing a German relief society. The Harnischfeger Corporation was one of 8 Midwestern concerns holding war contracts that were ordered by the President's Fair Employment Practices Commission to stop discriminating against workers because of race or religion. The commission charged on April 12, 1942, that these firms had refused to employ Jews or Negroes and had advertised for only Gentile, white Protestant help. After 1945, Harnischfeger made several trips to Germany. He criticized the dismantling of German factories, denounced the war crimes trials, and urged the restoration of Germany's colonies. After Joe McCarthy became a senator, he inserted Harnischfeger's pronouncements in the Congressional Record, and Upton Close, the pro-fascist radio commentator, parroted the views to his radio audience. McCarthy's 1947 financial troubles, stemming from his stock market reverses and his heavy overload of loans from the Appleton State Bank, appeared to have been cured by this Wisconsin angel. Quote, I have made complete arrangements with Walter Harnischfeger to put up sufficient collateral to cure both our ulcers. And so again, note that the deep politics underlying Joe McCarthy's financial backers and supporters in Wisconsin go back to the same German-American Fifth Column that we looked at in connection with the Steuben Society and with Donald Trump's historical connections to the Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S. that was never purged at the end of World War II. We went into that at great length in For the Record 918 and reviewed it in For the Record 919 and further developed it later. Just do a search on the website in the For the Record category for Steuben. Now, discussing the deep politics of the Russiagate PSYOP, and maybe it's just that. It would not be complete without talking about Robert Mueller. We don't have a lot of time. Mueller had headed the FBI by George Bush in, for the record, 310. I noted that Robert Mueller had been appointed head of the FBI by George W. Bush in early July of 2001. I noted I opined that this was done in order to obscure George W. Bush's links to business connections to the bin Laden family, because Robert Mueller had been a very special prosecutor indeed, or he was the investigator who proved less than vigorous in the BCCI investigation, and it is the BCCI nexus and people like Gayet Faron that helped to forge the business relationship between George W. Bush and the bin Laden family. When on March 20th, 2002, the Operation Green Quest raids took place, revealing profound links between the Republican Party and specifically Karl Rove and Grover Norquist's Islamic Free Market Institute, none other than Talat Osman, a director of Harkin Energy, a close business and political associate of both George's Bush and a protege of Gayet Faron of the BCCI, interceded on behalf of the individuals and institutions that were raided for financing terrorism on March 20th of 2002. This, and not the controlled demolition nonsense, is the real link between the Bush administration and the September 11th attacks, and it was covered up very effectively by Robert Mueller's FBI, as well as other legal and journalistic institutions. The actual article talking about this from the Wall Street Journal of April 18th, 2002, page A4, is almost impossible to come by online. The point being that, quote, Russiagate, unquote, special prosecutor Robert Mueller is a very special prosecutor indeed. This concludes For the Record program number 966, Dramatis Personae of the Russiagate PSYOP, being recorded on July 25th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have a good time.